CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 108, with Dr. Stephen Kleiss, an innovator, professor, and the king of the cornea.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest. That is Professor Steve Kleiss. You use his inventions, his devices, every day in your clinic. And I can't believe it's been 40 years since we first started video keratography. Stephen, welcome to our podcast.
Hey, thanks, Uday. It's such a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
For sure. Now, I was just thinking, it has been about 40 years, right, since we had the first video keratographers.
That's correct. I actually started in ophthalmology in 1964, believe it or not.
Wow.
Measuring the tear film and tear volume with Sai Mishima and Klaus Dolman and those guys back at the Retina Foundation in Boston. And eventually, you know, I ended up at LSU. Herb Kaufman gave me a call one day and made me an offer I just couldn't refuse. So I moved from Stanford to New Orleans in 1979, actually. And I was going to carry out my corneal physiology work and continue with that to figure out how the cornea stays clear and transparent and dehydrated. One day, Herb Kaufman barged into my office. You know, Herb is like a lion, and he came barging in. He said, "Steve, we're doing all this refractive surgery stuff on the cornea. We have no idea how we're changing it. You know, we measure the visions, and we measure K readings, but that's about it. What can you do to help us?" So that really was the stimulus for the whole development of corneal topography analysis.
Wow. So you've always had a big interest in the cornea and all this and the eye since you said 1964, but then you also even had a PhD at Yale in basically the physiology, the physics of the cornea.
That's
and then
right.
You went to Stanford and you were a professor there for faculty, and then you got recruited to LSU.
Yes. Yeah, that's all true. And
wow.
Yeah, I've been around. So Boston, New Haven, Palo Alto, New Orleans, and finally now we're on Long Island. I'm hooked up as an adjunct professor with Mount Sinai in Manhattan.
Oh, fantastic. They're so fortunate to have you. Now tell me, how did you get the ideas to get a video keratography going? We used to call it a video keratoscope. Today it's modern day topography, but before it was different.
Yeah, well, it used to be, when I came into the field, there were keratoscopes. They're basically an illuminated Placido disc with a Polaroid camera behind it. And we used to take pictures of the Myers reflected from the cornea. And if the cornea is really irregular, then, you know, you could see the irregularity in the Myers. But the problem is that's not a very sensitive way to analyze the curvature of the cornea. And as I said, Herb Kaufman came barging into my office one day and said, "What can you do to help us?" And so I studied what Jim Rousey had originally done, trying to computerize the Meyer pattern reflected from the corneas. And so I was able to think about that a little bit and see if there's a way that I couldn't present that data, grab it digitally, which I did by hand, tracing enlargements of keratoscope Myers, and then transforming that using a little mathematics. I'm pretty good at that. To transform it to a three-dimensional structure and to calculate the curvatures at all the points on the cornea, and so that was really the beginning, and the hard part. Okay, now I've got 20,000 points, right? I can show Uday Devgan all these numbers, but, you know, there's too much information there. It's not in a form that can be really understood. And so I started out by making transforms of elevation and anaglyphs, you know, with a red and blue lens, you could make three-dimensional pictures of the shape of the cornea. But that didn't seem to work. And my mother was an artist, actually. Okay. And so I thought of her and I thought of colors. And So in the end, we put together a color-coded contour map that shows the deviations and using colors to trans, you know, basically give you the information you need to see. What areas of the cornea are steeper than normal? What areas of the cornea are flatter than normal? Mm-hmm. So that was the beginnings of the color-coded contour map, which is now the universal standard, in not only in ANSI standards, but in the ISO standards. So we were very pleased to have been able to come up with that, because now you guys, you can look at a color map and say, oh, as long as it's done properly, you know, with a fixed scale and so on, you can look at the color map and say, oh, that guy has keratoconus, or that patient has, you know, something else, lots of irregular astigmatism. What are we going to do about it?
So it's a neat way of getting a tremendous amount of data into my brain instantly. So I can understand the relationship just by looking at this color picture on my topography or tomography, and I'll understand it instantly.
Yeah, that was exactly the point. And so that was a hit.
Your mom was right. The colors are the best way of doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I was living in New Orleans at the time, you know, and I was sort of walking through the French Quarter and passing all these art shops and so on and so forth. And it just struck me one day that would be and actually, you know, it turns out that was the first time that kind of a color presentation was ever used in science. I mean, if you looked at the geological survey maps and so on and so forth, there were a few shades of brown and a little green. But now if you look at many data presentation forms, they have the same spectral colors that we developed, I developed basically for corneal topography. So it was a bigger than, you know, just for cornea. It really, I think it contributed something to the science world, to the presentation of data and shapes and so on and so forth.
Right. And I should also add that you are our ophthalmology representative for ANSI and ISO, ANSI, American National Standards Institute, and ISO. So you get to interact with scientists from all other aspects of science, not just medicine, not just ophthalmology.
Yes, that's certainly true. And it's a teaching thing for me. I learn a lot from the other engineers that are in the room, and we have a good time trying to come up with standards that will fit and help the progress of science and ophthalmology and other medicine applications.
Right. I'd say, yeah, when I look at patients now, first thing I do on a topography or tomography map is look at the map, look at the pictures. Yeah. Then maybe I'll dive into what are some of the numbers.
Yeah, right. Oh, sure. You know, you know that what the normal K readings are. And right. So if a patient comes in with a large amount of a big disparity in K readings with a cylinder of 6 diopters or so, I mean, that's not normal. And you know where to take that. So,
and you also said it's important to get the right parameter. So like when I'm looking at my topography map, I need to make sure I have the right kind of step variation, step heights, right?
That's very important. And I used to argue with George Waring III about this all the time. Steve Wilson and I published an article showing that everything of really clinical significance could be shown using a 1.5 diopter step in corneal topography. Mm-hmm. And George Waring III said that, oh, no, that's not possible. You have to use a half diopter scale. And so I said, fine, you should use whatever sensitivity is you're comfortable with, and but stick with it. Don't use a variable scale. Make sure that every map has the same sensitivity interval. That way you can spot something that's different from what you're used to. Right. That's the whole point.
So where should we put our scale now? For your average ophthalmologist who's doing, let's say, a lot of cataract surgery, looking at a cornea on every patient just to make sure everything goes okay, what's a good screening level to put for our steps?
Well, so we still stand by the 1.5 diopter interval. It's called the Kleiss-Wilson scale on some topographers. That same scale, I think, is on Pentacam as well. and as well as most of the corneal topographers. It's also specified in the ANSI standards. But do what's comfortable to you. If you feel there are times, for example, using a 1.5 to 1.5 scale, that you see something and said, I want a closer look. Well, change the scale to 0.5 and take a look. Or my good friend Paolo Venciguerra loves to use a different kind of curvature calculation. He uses the tangential power map, which emphasizes local changes in curvature much more than the axial power map. And when you do that, you can see the transition zone in a myopic refractive surgery very clearly. And so he loves to do that because he's aiming to improve the results of LASIK by widening the optical zone. And you can't really see the optical zone unless you use this tangential power display. So there's no hard and fast rule, but routine for all of my, the residents and people who are beginning to learn corneal topography, start out with 1.5 diopter scale. And as I said, if you want to look more closely at something, you can. The ability is there on all topographers to increase the sensitivity and do it and have a look. But for routine use, always use the same scale, whatever you choose, because otherwise you won't know where you are. And we just came from telling it like it is. You did a wonderful cataract coach presentation there, as well as some of the other lectures. And we saw so many presentations where people showed, this is before, and this we cross-linked, and this is 6 months later, and they look totally different. Well, I think it was Biren who pointed out that well, by the way, you had two different scales there.
Right.
So it's like, come on, guys. We need to all think about this when we present topography. I don't care what scale you use, but keep it the same from photograph to photograph.
Right.
Point it out.
For sure. Well, because your brain gets used to it. My brain is used to this color green is going to be this K value.
Yeah, there you go.
So if you change the scale, now all of a sudden it's totally different. So I like what you're saying. Stick with the same for all. And obviously, if you're going to show before and after, you have to use the same scale.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Now, how you also developed a lot of these various indices. So to be able to get the data from the topography and say, hey, here's an index or indices that'll tell us, do you have a high risk for keratoconus? How do you develop all these ideas? These were amazing.
Yeah. Well, actually, now everyone is saying, AI is brand new. Wow, we've got to think about AI and that sort of thing. Actually, we did the first AI in ophthalmology, actually in medicine, back in 1986, 88, something like that. We developed the first. We started with developing indices that would relate to the potential visual acuity of the patient. If a cornea is rough, how do you know if that roughness is going to interfere with vision? Well, so we did the first clinical trial we did with Steve Dingledine and Steve Wilson to take the clinical visions and the topography of those patients and correlate those visions with indices derived from the corneal topography. Indices that early on we use very, very straightforward approaches that turn out to be as sensitive as some of the more sophisticated methods to measure the lumpy bumpiness, I like to say, how irregular is the cornea. And you can do that just by looking at the change in the position of Myers going from the center out to the peripheral meridian. And so the first index that we developed was called the Surface Regularity Index.
Okay.
And basically, nowadays in fancy terms, we talk about higher order aberrations. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what this actually measures from a simple, I take the simple approach usually.
Of course.
And this is the most direct and simplest approach. Forget about fitting a surface with a three-dimensional structure, which is what Zernike polynomials do. just use the actual data and see how irregular it is. Correlate that with visual acuity. We did that, and we had a correlation coefficient of 0.8.
Wow. You know,
which is very strong correlation from the actual vision of the patient to the index. And so we actually put this index on one of the first topographers we helped develop for Tome, the TMS-1. And that index is still there. It's been ported to other topographers, including some of the NIDEC devices and so on. The next step, really, and that really worked well. But the physiological optics types, my people I worked with, Ray Applegate and Howie Howland and a few other people, said, "Oh, this is not sophisticated enough. We need to do this right." So they said the way to measure aberrations on the cornea is to fit the corneal surface with Zernike polynomials.
Okay.
Zernike polynomials will give you the higher order aberrations, which now the clinicians understand. Higher order aberrations is a fancy way of saying irregular astigmatism, right? I mean, it's the same thing.
Right.
But we can now use that and put numbers. We can measure the different types of aberration, spherical aberration for example. Actually, spherical aberration is your friend. It can be your friend. Too much.
Give you some more depth.
Yes, sir. More depth of field, and or it can be your enemy if it goes in the wrong direction. You know, the natural lens of the eye has some spherical aberration, and the cornea of the natural cornea of the eye compensates for some of that spherical aberration to improve the optics of the eye.
Right,
and one of the important points Ray Applegate always used to say, and still says to this day, that not all aberrations are bad, and that you really don't know the impact. It's something you can't put in your brain to be able to involve the types of aberrations with how the optical quality of the eye, and you have to really just do the math and make a convolution of the aberrations. Some aberrations actually improve vision. I think it was Steve Schallhorn, wasn't it? You know, Top Gun pilot instructor,
right.
Top Gun pilot found in his work that a little bit of vertical coma actually correlated with better flight performance.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, what more proof do you need that not all aberrations are bad? But some aberrations are bad. And the only way to know for sure the impact of an aberration or a small optical zone on vision is to actually do a convolution. And this was started years ago by several people. And now we can just do that with many topographers. In fact, the iTrace has a version of that with the letter E. The only problem with their implementation, and I've been beating up Joe Keel on this, is that they should show, you don't know what E that is. Is that a 2200E or a,
all right.
You know, you don't know where that E is on the Snellen chart. So I said, just do the exact same thing, but use the lower half of the Snellen chart. Right. Now you're done, you know, so that you guys can really understand the impact of aberrations on vision. Because like I've been trying to say, you really can't do that intuitively. It's just,
right.
There's too many factors to consider.
Yeah, like on the NIDEC machine, the NIDEC OPD scan, it'll print out like a little ETDRS chart, and it'll show you the effect that the cornea basically is having on distorting that chart.
That's exactly true. In fact, I'm responsible for that.
Oh,
as a matter of fact,
I use it all the time.
I should disclose my current disclosures. Financial relationships include NIDEC, and really, and my wife works with Oculus, so So that's another disclosure, but those are basically the current disclosures that are relevant to this discussion.
Well, any surgeon who's using a topographer or a tomographer is in some ways standing on your shoulders.
Well, yeah, and I'm standing on the shoulders of those who came before us.
Of course.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, I started out at the Retina Foundation. My boss was the first year was Sai Mishima, who is a very talented. In fact, the paper I did with him is my highest cited reference of all time. A determination of tear flow and tear volume in the eye, in the human eye. And so I started out with him. He was hired by Columbia University subsequently after 1 year. And then I worked with Klaus Dolman, who's my boss. Klaus was an incredible guy. And, you know, he's a very busy clinician. So I just sort of started doing my own research and publishing my own papers and talking about my research at meetings. And he actually kicked me out. After 3 years, he said, "Steve, you've got to go get a license to do research." And so I said, "Okay." So I went to Yale and got my license in 3 years, and the rest is history. But I had the advantage of working with and working for a number of incredible luminaries in our field.
Yeah. Right. I did a little research here. You've got hundreds of published papers with a tremendous spectrum of names. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And I really owe whatever I have now, I owe to those collaborators.
For sure.
I tell you that it's, I don't just put my name on a paper, but on the other hand, I've had so many very talented people working with me that it just gives me a good feeling all over.
That's awesome. Like, going back a little bit, you're talking about sphere collaboration, the Z40 Zernike term, which, you know, in ophthalmology, you kind of made a big deal of. And you're saying, yeah, the cornea has a little bit of negative sphere collaboration, which is just relatively stable throughout life. The human lens starts off when we're young with a little plus positive sphere collaboration. And then it actually gets more and more, the lens gets more and more sphere collaboration as we age. Maybe that makes sense, because as we get presbyopic, now we have less accommodative amplitude. We're 50 years old, and now our human lens has a little more positive sphere collaboration. So now the net of the eye is not zero sphere collaboration. It's actually a little positive, maybe it slightly degrades image quality, but it improves my depth of focus.
Absolutely. And of course, the pupil is your friend too, because that averages 3.5 or 4 when you're photopically, when you're, you know, your age, but when you're my age, it's down around 2.5 millimeters. So that's that also increases the depth of field.
Yeah, for sure. Even further help. And a lot of times surgeons are a little bit, I think, overly concerned sometimes with the spherical collaboration of the eye and not worrying about what's called the lower order aberrations, which is my basically sphere and sill.
Yes.
If you can't hit the sphere and sill, why are you worrying about the spherical collaboration?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, you guys have figured out pretty well the what lens to put in the eye so far. As long as the cornea is your friend and is not aberrated, it's a fairly straight shot. You can worry about the biometry of the rest of the eye. And as far as biometry goes, I guess the big bugaboo still is where the lens is actually going to end up in the eye. You place it in, and what is the effective lens position in the eye? And but everything else, basically the axial length and corneal parameters and so on and so forth, that's also easily measured nowadays. It's just being able to predict the position of the lens in the eye. That's the problem.
Right. I mean, our challenge is that the way we've evolved in cataract surgery is we take out that 4.5 millimeter thick human crystalline lens, the cataract, and replace it with this very, very thin IOL, usually a millimeter or less in thinness, and the capsular bag shrink wraps. And so where is the IOL optic going to eventually end up? What's the ELP, effective lens position? So yeah, that's one of our challenges. I think we've gotten really great at measuring axial length. We've gotten pretty darn good too at measuring the cornea, but I mean, yeah, the ELP is kind of the last hurrah.
Yeah, you'll figure it out because I mean, yeah, I think you probably need ultrasound to really get the anatomy of the anterior segment clearly illuminated, and then you could use that information along with AI to with a bunch of a few thousand patients, which probably you could do in a few weeks, to improve. And I know that that there are continuing efforts to use AI in lens formulas and lens calculations. Right. And it's not there yet, but I think what's missing is that piece of information.
Right. Well, my own disclosure is I'm a principal in Advanced Euclidean Solutions with my friend John Lattice, and that is, we have actually a new AI patent just issued February of this year, 2025. It's covering a very wide swath of that, and I think we're very consistently producing very significantly better results than any other existing formula or methodology.
What's the trick?
Well, we can't put all our cards on the table just yet.
Okay.
It's many, many years in the making.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're right. You need to look at all input variables, things that you can't really use today, but maybe will in the future. Like, what about equatorial lens position?
Mm-hmm.
What's the exact role, even from your realm, what's the exact role of the posterior cornea? Is it sufficient enough to just measure anterior corneas in everyone and then just kind of assume what the posterior cornea is? Or should we be measuring both?
Yeah. Well, Doug Koch used to say you have to measure both.
Yeah.
His last talk in ACOS, I think it was last year, in Aspen, I think it was. I have a picture of his slide that says, well, the posterior surface doesn't really matter that much. so, you know, we're allowed to change our minds. You know?
Well, as a habit for every cataract patient, I'm going to measure basically three sets of Ks. I'm going to have a topography. I'm going to have a tomography device, Galilei or Pentacam. And then I'm going to have also my biometer, my LensStar or my Argos device that's going to give me its own set of Ks. And ideally, I like to see all the Ks line up. Mm-hmm. And when I do the IOL, let's say I do toric lens calculations based on the anterior corneal astigmatism, I then like to look at the posterior corneal astigmatism or the total eye or TCP, let's say on the Galilei, total corneal power. And I want to say, is it the same?
Yeah.
Well, like I got a few checks to make sure it's, you know, in the same ballpark.
Yeah. Well, the problem. Keratometry per se is very inaccurate. We have a paper on that. You can be off by a diopter and a half of the true corneal power. We developed years ago an index called the average central corneal power. Okay. Basically, it measures the average corneal power over the entrance pupil of the eye, corrected a little bit for Stiles Crawford, and Jack Holliday also has that kind of an index on some of the formulas and devices he's worked with. But it's much better to measure the average corneal power over the pupil than over here, you know, especially if the patient has had any refractive surgery or other abnormality in corneal shape. So, you know, I think you'll do a lot better with your calculations if you use that power rather than try to match up keratometry. Keratometry is
just not as accurate.
Well, it's it was invented before you were born.
Right.
Well before you were born.
Maybe even before both of us. I mean,
yes, either one of us.
Like when I was a resident many years ago, they had those manual keratometers, which were just kind of a little bit of guesswork.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, think about using average corneal power, and I don't know which machine. It might be on the NIDAC machine that you have. I haven't looked at that closely.
Yeah, it does have our average power of the cornea. It does for sure.
Use it.
Yeah, you know, for sure.
You'll be happy.
No, I'm already very happy. So we're using all the above. But my main question, like when we're looking at correcting astigmatism at the time of cataract surgery, just simple astigmatism, which is obviously easily corrected with a toric lens, etc. Is it okay for us to just kind of really hone in on that central cornea? So we've got a lot of patients who have maybe borderline, a little FFKC, and you're going to do their IOL surgery, and you say, look, they've got some irregular astigmatism. They've got a little bit of inferior steepening. The patient's 80 years old, probably not going to get any more developing in the future.
Correct.
But looking at this eye, at least in the central 3 millimeters, which is where the pupil is, it looks pretty regular. Can I put a toric lens in?
Why not?
No, I mean,
well, we're doing. I mean, it depends on the other aberrations. I mean, if the primary aberration is cylinder over the entrance pupil, then that seems like a good choice. But if the coma is impacting the vision, then the patient is not going to be as happy as it could be.
Yeah, I think it's definitely important to look at all that, because I've had some patients who have mostly just, you know, simple astigmatism cylinder, who've been very, very happy. And then the other ones, unfortunately, if they have other higher order aberrations, the challenge is now you want to put the toric lens in, and they say post-op, well, let me go back to my RGP contact. Well, now RGP contact now unmasks the toric power of the IOL. So now you have to have a front surface of the piggyback with a toric to balance out the IOL toric.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a conundrum. So it's hard to know. I mean, I've got all these ideas flashing through my mind. I mean, it would be really nice if we had a, let's say one of the topographers could tell you the impact of these various IOLs on vision, what it looks like. You know, the patient has a little bit of coma, but you want to put a toric IOL in there to correct the cylinder. What is the impact of the residual coma, which you're not going to correct with a toric or an AK procedure? You really need to be able to assess that to make a good medical decision, right?
Yeah, you're right. But I think it sounds like a pretty easy software problem. I've got a machine that has all the aberrations. I can just filter out, don't show me the sphere and the sill, assume those are both zero, and now show me the effect of the rest of the higher order aberrations on the Snellen chart or whatever you have.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Well, first of all, in fact, I've been thinking of doing that with the NIDAC or another topographer. But you need to obtain all the optical characteristics of the various lenses that you would choose to use. And I don't have that data. I'm sure it's available, or maybe not, because some of these are trade secret kind of things.
Right. But couldn't you just assume, let's just say, assume that your toric monofocal lens is going to, let's say, you know, knock out all the sphere and all the sill, and just take out those two parts of the equation, and then just leaving the rest of the whole Zernike pyramid, take off the Z2 level, which is sphere and sill, and leave Z3 and lower.
Yeah.
And then.
Okay. That's doable. That's doable. It makes no assumptions about what you're going to put in the eye. If you just said, okay, I'm going to eliminate the sill in this eye, what are the residual aberrations going to do to my patient's vision? Yeah, perfect. Yeah, actually, yeah. Well, I'll write an email today.
I was going to say, let's start pursuing this. Look at that. What a neat idea. Yeah. I wish I could take any credit, but I'm just trying to, I'm looking at it from the clinician side. What would be easy for me?
Of course. I mean, just about everything I've done research-wise has been to try to make your guys' life happier. You know, that you want the patient to smile after surgery and not come back and say, "Doc, this is terrible. You got to take it out."
Right, of course, exactly. That one patient like kind of negates all the happiness from hundreds of other patients. It's just such we beat ourselves up over that one patient all the time. So if I'm a clinician, what is the minimum I should be doing? Let's say I'm going to do cataract surgery, right? U.S. is most common surgery, 4 million a year. I'm going to do cataract surgery in a patient. What do I need to evaluate on the cornea to make sure I get a good outcome? Is a topography just enough? Or do I need to go more, do more than this?
Well, yeah, they're This is not easy to answer that. On a normal cornea, all you need is front surface characteristics of the cornea. That's it. On a normal cornea. What if it's not a normal cornea, and why isn't it normal? Then you have to dig deeper, and it's still the front surface has 80% of all the vergence in the eye. It's the most critically important refractive element, right? The front surface, the tear film of the cornea. Of course, when I say normal cornea, I'm also cataract surgeons now know that they've got to cure dry eye disease before doing all their biometry, and that's a whole other topic. But once you've corrected the deficiencies of the tear film, then it's a matter of the true shape of the cornea, whether there's some coma or whatever. Whether or not the endothelium, the posterior surface of the cornea, really makes a difference, that just requires more data. And as I said, Doug Koch's group was the first to say, oh, you can't do cataract surgery unless you measure the shape of the posterior cornea. And now he's saying, well, yeah, it doesn't really matter. Meaning probably that it probably has a minor influence in some patients.
Right.
That, I think that's how I interpret what he's saying. So so what are you going to do beyond that? Now, the latest thing is you've got to spend another $80,000 or $100,000, because you have to do OCT. You have to have epithelial thickness profiles, right? Or you're not practicing state-of-the-art medicine. This brings up a very important issue, and that is the cost of all this equipment. And
yes,
the cost of surgery. You guys get paid nothing, but you've got to spend maybe $250,000 for photographers, tomography, all these other things. And if you're going to get a laser, oh my God, you know, well, of course you have to have a femto nowadays, right? So how are you going to transmit that technology to performing cataract surgery in the backwoods in Africa somewhere? I mean, it's impossible. You can't, there's no way to do that. We've been thinking about that for some time. In fact, about 10 years. And 10 years ago, we started to develop a smartphone-based corneal topographer that sits on a slit lamp that would retail for less than $1,000. That could go anywhere, and it transmits to Elon Musk's Starlink system by Wi-Fi to the cloud. So all of the data is there, not only for use for developing new AI models, but also for remote recommendations for what to do, the management of different patients, and so on and so forth. And the problem is it's a whole new paradigm. It doesn't perform the surgery, it doesn't do cataract work. It's only a corneal device. That's the problem. But at least it's an approach. It's a new approach to getting diagnostics out into the outback, you know, where it can't be afforded. You guys with your femto laser and all the diagnostic equipment that you have, you're making modern diagnosis and modern cataract surgery unbelievably wonderful, along with the technology that is coming out with the new contact lenses, intraocular lenses, and I mean, it's phenomenal. It's really phenomenal medicine, and I'm a recipient of that technology myself. A couple of ZC Boos and at -2, which is what I wanted, because I've always been -2 in my whole life.
Hey, you and I are buddies. Guess who else is -2? That's me.
All right. Yeah, I don't really need to wear these for up close work, but. Yeah, and so meanwhile, my wife was a -10, and now she's Plano at distance, and she's got her readers hanging around her neck all the time. So Anyway,
No,
that
you and I get spoiled. You and I get spoiled. Being minus two is such a gift.
It is. It is really. I started wearing, well, I've been minus two just about my whole life, but I started wearing spectacles when I was young, and it was a good thing because my father was an engineer, and he would bring me to work. And at the age of eight, I would stand on an apple crate and use the lathe with, you know, metal chips flying around. And
Nice.
And it was a, for me, it was a protective mechanism, as well as, you know, I spend most of my day working within 18 inches of in my eyeball. So,
right. No, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you were saying, should we have maybe then split cataract surgery into just basic cataract surgery to clear your visual axis, and then cataract surgery as a refractive outcome, as a refractive procedure? Because you're right. When I have to buy $250,000 of diagnostic equipment, I got to buy $500,000 of stuff in the operating room to do your surgery. That's for refractive outcomes. Whereas cataract surgery is just to fix the cataract. So
yeah.
Maybe we need to separate the two, because otherwise we're making it needlessly expensive. The barrier to entry is like $1 million of equipment.
Yeah.
And for what? Then we still have a world full of patients who are blind from cataracts.
Yes. Yeah. Well, in India, that problem has been solved to some extent by some of the clinics. And
right.
One of the clinics that I've been to in Hyderabad, for example, if a patient comes in, they have no means to support the surgery. They take a left. If they have some dollars, they go to the right. Back in those days, the IOL cost was like $5
mm-hmm.
per lens. And, you know, there are ways. You don't, do we really need 20/16 vision when we're, you know, 85 years old? I don't know. I mean, I like it. I like 20/16, but I'm happy with, in fact, there's a whole other issue, about bringing people into cataract surgery, when they should be, you know. I, for example, I'll take myself as a bad patient, married to an ophthalmologist, by the way. And, but anyway, so I was having trouble on a rainy night driving home one night. I said, you know what? Maybe I'm getting cataracts. Who knows? You know? So I went in, and doc said, well, we got you up to 20/70 in this eye and 20/50 in the other eye. In other words, I was not a legal driver in the state of New York, but I mean, I was, you see, cataracts develop so slowly. Unless it's a traumatic event or something, you just don't understand that you're losing vision until you really can't. You lose the ability to do something that you normally do without a problem. So how do we get people in to measure their vision? And by the way, now that there's a device called the SimVis that Susanna Marcos developed. She's an incredible lady, that allows you to experience trifocals, monofocals, monovision, you know, different combinations of cataract surgery prior to the surgery. So you can choose whether or not you can adapt to this extended vision, or, you know, whatever you want. In fact, I would have chosen monovision had I had that test before. But the problem is, patients come in, they're 20/50, 20/70, like myself. Maybe it's too late to use this.
Right. If the lens is so opaque, the cataract's already so opaque, how do you get
right.
the...
How can you tell what's going to be good? Right. Everything will look good, you know. So that's a problem. That's something you guys need to work on, is how to bring people in for their annual exam.
Right.
And most people, then, if it doesn't hurt, you don't complain, you don't go in.
Right. Well, especially men. I think it's like, if we look at our cataract patients in the U.S., I think that my cataract patient is probably like 68% women. More women than men. Women will come in. Men, whatever reason, maybe we're hard-headed.
Yeah.
We think, if it's not broken, don't fix it. I'm fine. I'm fine. Leave me alone.
What brings the women in, though? They can't see the eyeliner, or, you know.
I don't know. Maybe they're smart. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? But, yeah, very interesting. You know, monovision's still on the table for you. You can always try contact with one eye, and if you love it, do PRK or LASIK.
Oh, I love monovision. In fact, with this Symvis device that I was mentioning, she made me monovision with near in one eye and distance in the other eye, and then switched it around. I could not tell with my eyes open. I could not tell which eye was which. I mean, I had continuous range of vision from near to distance. So I would have done that in a heartbeat had I been able to experience that.
You can do PRK in one eye. Make one eye Plano.
Yeah.
In fact, I know a great surgeon. She's famous for doing PRK. He did the world's first one, and you may know her too.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. You know some people.
if you guys didn't get the inside joke there yet, Dr. Kleiss's wife is Dr. Marguerite McDonald, who is obviously was on a podcast previously, a pioneer in laser refractive surgery.
Yes. So, yeah.
You can still do it if you like it.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, we worked together in the development of the first Visix 2020 laser back in
the day. Tell me about that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Tell me about how that came around. Developing the Visix laser.
Well, it's all about it started with me going to LSU. Herb wanted a physiologist, a corneal physiologist on the team, and actually Randy Olson was there at the time, and he also was promoting it because he's a good scientist himself, and unfortunately he was leaving as I came in, but nevertheless I was hired actually as the physiologist, and I developed a computer system for the whole department, and I, you know, continued my NIH-funded corneal physiology research until he, well, I continued that, but he came in and they started doing epikeratophakia, and I worked with Ted Werblin to develop the formulas necessary to lathe the tissues, and so I got involved early on, and all the refractive procedures that were being developed there, and it was a natural when they started working with lasers that I would participate in that too. I have a very significant engineering background, I've built many devices from scratch, basically. In fact, the first device I made in ophthalmology was a fluorophotometer that measured the concentration of fluorescein in the tears. And we, at the Retina Foundation, we had a staff shop, and I found a bunch of old army surplus parts, and for $20, I made the basis for this for this instrument and the paper that we published on tear film. So I participated in the development, and actually, the first handpiece had a little level in it. Okay. And of course the surgeon is looking through the scope at the patient's eye, couldn't see the level. So I would hold Marguerite's hand and tilt the cornea to make sure the centration was correct. And then she would step on the pedal and do the treatment. Well, at our wedding, Charles Mungerlin, who was basically the head engineer of Visix at the time and developed the laser, presented us with a little gift. And in that box was that little handpiece that he said, I did it. I was the one responsible for you guys getting together. So
amazing.
Of course,
the beam has to come down straight. You don't want the beam coming at an angle, right?
Well, we want it. It's like what you do now. It needs to be centered on the pupil, right? So that had to be aligned to get the pupil planar and centered under the laser. So Steve Troquel was part of that group too, and he's still going strong. He's 90 years old now. We went to his birthday a few months ago, and he's a heck of a guy. In fact, we hope to that he'll come to the Aegean cornea meeting in June. It's going to be held in Crete this June.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Cornea, GN cornea and cataract, it's called.
Oh, fantastic.
Incredible meeting, 3-day meeting of science and clinical observations, and followed by 5 days on sailing on the water from island to island. So,
and the Aegean Sea, yes, beautiful.
Yeah, this is the 17th meeting. So,
wow, fantastic. Now, it just strikes me that, wow, LSU at the time was basically like the birthplace of at least American refractive surgery. It's huge.
Yeah. It was quite a department. Herb built it from basically nothing. He came in 1978. I came in 1979. Marguerite came in 1980, and it grew and grew. That 1 year, we had 20% of all ARVO abstracts came from our department of ophthalmology.
Wow.
Yeah. It was amazing. It was our time. And, you know, we had other people in retina, actually, Golan Payman. He was also,
oh, for sure.
He also had a patent on laser surgery of the cornea.
The laser patent.
Yeah. So, it was quite a department. It's very exciting to be there. Right. We had some of the most incredible residents and fellows that passed right. through. I can tell you it was a wonderful experience. My contributions were enhanced enormously by the team of people that Herb and Marguerite attracted to that department.
Yeah, just that so much came out of there. It's really quite amazing. Yeah, and like you were saying with Golan Payman, fantastic guy. I know him personally. I've asked him to be on the podcast. He's a little bit more shy than most, so he's
But
if you just look at the 300 patents he has in ophthalmology, it's like amazing, mind blowing.
He and Mandy Conway, she's a retina person, were some of our best friends, and we still we stay in contact and. See them at meetings and so on. But
yeah, it's just amazing to see how far we've come. Like how many things that we as cataract surgeons just take for granted, or even corneal refractive surgeons as well, take for granted, but how these were decades in the development. And to go from our first device of that very basic video keratography device to what I have now with these fancy topographers and tomographers and measuring the higher vibration, it's mind blowing.
Yeah. Well, it's had a long history, and basically the field was really waiting for digital computing to come of age.
Right.
And the first topography program that I wrote ran on a Digital Equipment Corporation VAX computer, my laboratory computer, and when the first IBM PC was born, I bought it.
And the 8088.
And actually the 8088 chips came before the PC, but then the PC was developed, and we bought one of the first ones and ported our programs onto the PC, and then it became practical to start to think about making a corneal topographer. And so that was I forget what year it was. Time passes so fast.
Probably very early 80s or late 70s.
Early 80s, yeah. Early 80s, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, I remember because at the time I was a kid, I couldn't afford a real IBM PC. And so what I ended up doing was like piecing together. I got the 8088 processor, and you can get a motherboard. And
yeah.
You can piece a generic one together, which is what I ended up doing.
Yeah, at Stanford. I got a cosmetic chipset, 8088 chipset from Intel. We were in Palo Alto nearby, and an engineering student came in. Is there anything I can do with your research? I said, no, I think so. So I spent 100 hours. I designed a computer, basically a digital analog computer that would run a scanning microscope to measure corneal thickness. For expended periods of time, experiments ran 24 hours, and so I designed this thing with about 10 pages of of diagrams. I handed it to him. Took him about 100 hours to I gave him the chips and the board, and I taught him how to use a soldering iron. Can you believe that? A double E major at Stanford. What's that? Soldering iron? What's that? You know, so I really believe on teaching hands-on.
Of course.
You know, do it yourself, build it yourself. And so I taught him how to use a soldering iron and a wire wrap tool. And he came back with the computer, and we hooked it up. And the damn thing almost worked. But the high byte and the low byte enabled pins on the analog devices A to D converter were reversed. So we were getting a sawtooth instead of a ramp. And so the design and the production was perfect, but you know, we fixed that little manufacturer error, and you know, it's still running. You know, it's probably still running today. 8080A chip, yeah. So you did that sort of thing too. That's great.
Oh, I think a lot of us in ophthalmology we're all geeks.
Yeah,
it's in the blood.
It's a nice field to be in if you're a geek. I can tell you.
No, for sure. In fact, again, I want to thank you for making all these toys for us and giving us so much information. I mean, literally, we all on a daily basis use things that you have had a big hand in bringing to us.
Yeah,
and we're thankful.
Well, it's been not even a challenge. It's been just an opportunity that I've really thank everyone for helping to produce that.
It's I can't wait to see what the future brings. It's going to be amazing. Oh,
the future lies ahead. Remember that.
For sure. Well, again, Steve, thank you so much for doing this podcast. I really appreciate it. I cannot believe we've been talking for an hour already.
Really? Oh my gosh. Oh yeah. Well,
fun.
Well, thank you very much. You're my favorite coach, Cataract or otherwise. And
thank you so much. I want to remind our viewers and listeners, remember, I got a new podcast every single Sunday on Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google, and where you find your podcasts, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. And remember, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every day, more than 2,500 days in a row and counting. And now we also have a new Retina Rounds video every single day. Check it out. So until next week, I'll check you later.